Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Monday, January 18th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are myself, Teresa Whitaker, and Dorothy Hockenberg. Here is our first story. Police at home before fire. Two dead at scene. Domestic incident reported same day. This is by Tom Lowy and Anthony Watt. The neighbor who called in Tuesday morning's house fire in the 5200 block of North Division Street said police visited the home often. Two people were found dead in the home during the post-fire investigation of the two-family, one-story conversion built in 1979. Davenport police had been to the address hours before the fire. A call for service occurred at 11:46 p.m. on Monday, according to the service logs. The call was for a report of a domestic disturbance or violence. Firefighters were called at 3:55 a.m. to a report of fire at the residence. Two calls came after the blaze was extinguished and the bodies were found. The first was made at 7:55 a.m. on Tuesday and the other at 12:50 p.m. Both were reports of theft larceny, the logs state. The logs do not say what situation authorities found when they arrived, whether anyone was arrested in relation to any of the three calls, or whether they were related to the investigation of the deaths or the fire. Asked for more information Wednesday morning, the police department said no information or statements about the investigation were expected to be released Wednesday. The neighbor said she could see the smoke from the blaze from a few blocks away. I was coming home early Tuesday and saw a huge smoke cloud, the neighbor said. I thought it might be my house, but we got closer, we saw it was the neighbor. We called 911 right away. There were flames coming out of the windows. According to a news release from Davenport Police, firefighters arrived on the scene to find moderate smoke coming from one of the units. The fire was quickly extinguished. When firefighters searched the residence, they located two people who were deceased. The names and ages of the deceased were not released as of noon Wednesday. The incident is under investigation by the Davenport Police Department. The neighbor said the home had a lot of visitors, and the Davenport police were called to the home pretty often. I don't know what went on there, and really, we just tried to mind our own business, the neighbor said. But we noticed how often the police were there. The home has at least 7 surveillance cameras mounted to the home. Police ask anyone with information about this incident to call the Davenport Police Department at 563-326-6125. Crime Stoppers of the Quad Cities at 309-762-9500, or submit an anonymous tip via the P3 Tips mobile app, or submit a tip online at qccrimestoppers.com.
Okay, from the Quad City Times local, we have here Junior Theater Backers Worry About Housing Complex Plan by Sarah Watson. Advocates for junior theater expressed concern for its future with proposed plans to restore and repurpose portions of the Annie Wittenmeyer complex into affordable housing. The youth theater organization has called the complex home since 1976. The plans are still in early stages. Chris Ailes, a developer with experience with historic preservation projects, has proposed turning 20 of the complex's 27 buildings into 99 workforce and senior housing units. The city is proposing allowing Ailes conditional site control over, the city is proposing allowing Ailes conditional site control over the campus for roughly 1 year to secure financing from state and federal tax credits and other sources. The City Council held a public hearing Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. where the public could weigh in on whether the city should grant the year-long conditional site control. It'll vote next week on it. Although the on-campus theater program is not planned to be turned into housing, the 10 cottages that Junior Theater uses to house administration, rehearsal space, classes, store costumes, props, and set pieces are in the developer's plans to be repurposed into housing units. Under the current negotiations, the city would be able to lease back the theater and three adjacent cottages after the property is transferred to the developer, which is expected to be in July of 2025 if financing is secured. But the cottages would only be able to be leased for 6 months following the transfer because of the developer's desire to repurpose all 10 cottages into housing, said the city's Community and Economic Development Director Bruce Berger. Nicole Savatsky, a board member of the Junior Theater, urged the council to consider the future location of the theater program in its proposal for needed affordable housing. She acknowledged Junior Theater may need a long-term plan for location anyways, considering the expense of maintaining the buildings. She asked the city for time, resources, and to include Junior Theater more proactively in the discussions if they need to find a new home. We just wanted to make sure we didn't get lost in the shuffle, Savatsky told a reporter Wednesday night. Joseph Thomas, a former Junior Theater student, told the Planning and Zoning Commission on Tuesday he was concerned that Junior Theater would not be able to operate smoothly without cottage space. Unfortunately, Junior Theater would probably not be able to survive in its current capacity without the cottages along with the theater itself, Thomas said. Those have a symbiotic relationship. He said theater programs start to have trouble when administration, costumes, and storage are far from the theater where performances are held. Other speakers asked the city to make sure there was a viable plan in place for the future of Junior Theater before any developments would start, and emphasized the importance of Junior Theater to developing kids' public speaking skills and offering low-cost arts programming in the Quad Cities. Several speakers also said they supported affordable housing programs in the Quad Cities. Some speakers also spoke to the theater program's 72-year history and urged the city to keep that historical significance in mind. According to the Junior Theater's website, it is the second oldest children's theater in the United States. When the city bought the Annie Wittenmeyer Complex in 1976, it designated the campus chapel and three of the 10 cottages to the theater program, according to Junior Theater's website. The cottages became offices, technical, and rehearsal spaces, and the chapel became the Nightswander Theater, named for the program's founder, Mary Fleurer Nightswander. The program has since added a fourth cottage as a main stage production site, according to Junior Theater's website. Berger told the Planning and Zoning Commission that the city could lease the theater back for a dollar, but the theater would be costly to maintain. In theory, the good news is the city could lease back a dollar financially, the theater building. That would be viable. But one of the things that I think our park staff are wrestling with and will need to talk through with Junior Theater folks, with the Davenport Community Schools and others, is what does the long-range future look like, Berger said. This campus would have been difficult to maintain going into the future for the theater operation without a major investment of dollars, so this is a good prompt to look at what the future does look like. If it turns out that the project doesn't move forward, we will have maybe started that review process and can maybe look to the future of the Junior Theater at a more viable site, or perhaps reinvesting in this site. Asked by the commissioner whether Ailes could preserve the cottages for Junior Theater, Ailes said he was under the impression that the city didn't have the funds to make capital improvements needed for the cottages and the theater. I've done this for many years. I can say this with experience. It costs less money to build a new facility than it does to fix up an old one, Ailes said, adding that he supported Junior Theater and his granddaughters went through the program. I would hope they'd look at this as an opportunity to upgrade their facilities and find new facilities somewhere in the future, opposed to trying to retrofit part of the campus and then make it fit. Ailes said the developers would lose some of the economy of scale for the project without the cottages. At Wednesday's meeting, Ailes said, if asked, he could look again at whether the project was viable without some of the cottages. The Parks and Recreation Department is planning an input meeting with Junior Theater and community members, according to Parks Director Chad Dyson. Bottom line is Junior Theater is staying in Davenport. Mayor Mike Masson said in a Tuesday afternoon management update meeting with the council members. However, we can get it out. The Junior Theater is a wonderful thing in Davenport, and we are going to keep it. Specifically, where, we'll see. At large, Ald, Kyle Gripp acknowledged the Junior Theater's concern at Wednesday's 5:30 p.m. meeting of not being as involved in discussions about the future of the Annie Wittenmeyer complex. He said the city could have done a better job of including them and apologized. Gripp said repurposing the Wittenmeyer camps has been on his mind since he was first elected because of the maintenance needed for the buildings and the insufficient revenue from the city to make those improvements. The list of needed maintenance in general at the Annie Wittenmeyer complex includes roofs, plumbing, HVAC, windows, tuck pointing, and electrical, according to city staff. According to city staff, of all the complex's buildings, five are leased, four are vacant, and the city uses 15 buildings, about half of which are primarily used as storage on an infrequent basis. Another two buildings the city's Historic Preservation Commission approved for demolition. One is a garage, and the second had a water burst-related flood last year.
Sculptures, Smiles in the Snow. Women's yard art warms heart of passing kids and adults. Carissa Hardy Meyer wanted to give the children who walk by her house something to smile about while they trudge through the cold and snow to a nearby bus stop. The 31-year-old Davenport resident started with the piles of snow in front of her Arlington Avenue home. Hardy Meyer ended up with a sculpture of a triceratops, which neighborhood kids and their parents can ride. In the past, she has created sculptures of a dog, a life-size ancient warrior, and a mother holding a child. I have a house along a bus route, lots of kids in the neighborhood, and plenty of parents and kids that walk along our route. So after we moved in, I started making snow sculptures for fun to give them something to smile about on their way home, Hardy Meyer said. They've been a hit so far, with neighbors checking in on my progress as the night goes on and waking up to a finished one in the morning. Hardy Meyer has lived in the house on Arlington Avenue for 3 years with her fiancé, Tyler. The urge to create and share has been with her for a long time. Where others might see a pile of snow or a pile of sticks, she sees another world. I've always loved creating. I make all kinds of things from natural resources, like fairy houses from things in the woods for hikers to come across, stone art on riverbanks, and of course snow art, she said. Usually I just look at the pile of snow and make what I see as I look at it, but sometimes I'll take requests from friends just for fun. The whole point is to put smiles on people's faces. The sculpture of a horned dinosaur that lived between 65 and 80 million years ago catches a lot of eyes and attention. The dinosaur has stairs on the back so you can climb up on it, and some of the parents even hopped on with their kids for a picture. It's been a lot of fun, Hardy Meyer said. The sculptor succeeded in creating smiles in the sub-zero temperatures. One of those grins was on her face. With the mom and child sculpture, we had a touching moment where one neighbor girl begged her mom to bring the baby a bracelet as a gift, Hardy Meyer said. With the dog, kids brought her sticks and made her some snow puppy friends. Hardy Meyer doesn't plan to stop. Social media messages have been filled with suggestions. It's been a lot of fun. I plan on making more whenever we get a good snow, she said. Of the suggestions, the next time, I've gotten snow leopard, saber-toothed tiger, basically any character from the children's movie Ice Age, a narwhal, and a Viking ship. Hardy Meyer laughed at the idea of a Viking ship in her front yard. We're going to need a lot more snow for a boat, she said. It sounded like Hardy Meyer might have been riffing on Sheriff Brody's famous one-liner from Jaws. And what's a narwhal? It's not a mythical race of beings from Middle Earth or a Harry Potter story. It's not even a tribe that did combat with marauding Vikings. According to National Geographic, a narwhal is a medium-sized toothed whale that lives in Arctic waters around Greenland, Canada, and Russia. But get this, male narwhals have a tusk, which looks like a long horn, on the front of its face, which scientists say is a large canine tooth. They're the unicorn of the oceans, apparently, and it'd be sure to get some grins along the Arlington Avenue.
Okay, on the local news, changes eyed for USPS site in Milan by Gretchen Teske. As part of a $40 billion plan to upgrade and improve the mail process, the Quad Cities Processing and Distribution Center facility in Milan could see big changes. The United States Postal Service's 10-year Delivering for America plan lays out plans to improve the delivery process. The modernization and investment enhancement review will not result in the Milan facility closing or career employee layoffs, the USPS news release stated. The changes could see some mail processing operations move to other locations, with the facility instead becoming a local processing center, sorting and delivery center, or both. Local processing centers serve as connections between regional processing centers and distribution centers. Sorting and delivery centers combine delivery units into a central site. USPS has opened 29 sorting and delivery centers since the start of Delivering for America and anticipates soon opening 38 more, according to an FAQ provided by USPS. The FAQ said the study is just beginning and the initial findings could be released in the next 2 months. The review for Milan will look at how USPS can best allocate its resources to improve customer service and achieve cost savings. Business mail entry, post office station, and branch retail services are not expected to change, and delivery service will be unaffected throughout this review, the release states. In connection with the review, the Postal Service will evaluate the following: efficiency. The review includes looking at if efficiency can be increased by transferring some operations performed in Milan to the processing and distribution center in Des Moines. The review will determine if it would be more efficient to group mail and packages destined for outside the Quad Cities region with mail and packages from other areas going to the same places. Improving service. If improving efficiency and service can be achieved by investing in the Milan facility to redesign mail processing operations with modern operating strategies, equipment, and improved employee amenities. Expansion. If efficiency and service can be improved by expanding operations at the facility, including adding sorting and delivery functions currently being deployed throughout the nation, incorporating expanded retail functions currently being evaluated and deploying throughout the nation, or increasing local package delivery functions, including local transportation initiatives supporting new products being introduced. If moving some operations out of the facility is determined to be a good business decision, it is likely the facility would become a local processing center, sorting and delivery center, or both. Any such repurposing will result in a revitalized, modernized, and upgraded facility with improved employee amenities and a better working environment, the release states. The overall network redesign contemplated in the DFA plan is intended to reduce handlings, improve efficiencies, and optimize letter, flat, and package processing for the predictable, reliable, and cost-effective operations. Public input will be considered as part of the review. Community members are asked to submit comments online. This can be done so anonymously, and a public input meeting will be held also. There is no date for that meeting at this time. If the review determines changes for the Milan facility, a summary of the review will be posted on aboutusps.com at least 1 week prior to that meeting. The Postal Service will work closely with its unions and management associations throughout the facility review and will continually monitor the impact of any changes that are implemented and will adjust plans as necessary and appropriate, the release stated.
Workers back BHASED. Union staff support administration over leaders' demands. This is by Olivia Allen. Multiple Black Hawk area special education district staff union members showed their support for administrators Tuesday night, pushing back against recent demands from the current union president. As previously reported, staff union president Mark Buck, that's spelled B-U-Y-C-K, has demanded the resignation of BHASED director Christian Schrader and center principal Amy Skinner, accusing the pair of creating a hostile work environment, unsafe for students and staff, and practice unfair treatment of staff. At the BHASED governing board meeting Tuesday night, many in the crowd wore black shirts with "We support our admin" plastered across the front in pink print. During public comment, Alex Mahaffey, a teacher at the BHASED Center, said a significant portion of union members have been in the dark about Buck's recent actions and motivations. There was a lack of meetings, discourse, and democratic process concerning the undertaking of these actions, Mahaffey said on Tuesday. In fact, he said union members have petitioned to oust Buck in wake of the situation. This petition included more signatures than necessary, 30% of members, as per the bylaws, and we anticipate further support as well. We have submitted it to the executive board and await their response, Mahaffey said. Buck has accused administration of tyrannical behavior, yet has conducted himself in an aggressive, undemocratic manner in a way that is simply unheard of for leadership of any effective union. Some of Buck's behaviors prompting this petition, Mahaffey said, included calling for the immediate resignation of Schrader and Skinner without notifying or obtaining member approval, alongside conducting a picketing action and contacting media without member approval or discussion, threatening and targeting staff via email and the GroupMe chat who questioned his actions or disagreed with his methods, filing a former grievance against the administration for a matter of great union importance without following proper protocol, along with adding staff names to the grievance without their consent or prior knowledge, failing to properly end his term upon its July 2023 expiration. Many members even agreed or sympathized with the issues he brought up, but simply disagreed with his actions and behavior in response to these issues, Mahaffey said. Mahaffey closed by urging union members to address any concerns relating to BHASED in a positive and constructive way. American Bunker, a BHASED center nurse, said students, staff, and families feel cared for, respected, and encouraged each day, reading several testimonials on this front. Staff has consistently noted that they feel seen, heard, validated, and supported by our administrators, she said during public comment. Many have noted that this is unprecedented given their past employment history. However, at BHASED, it is the norm. Skinner also gave a public comment Tuesday. When I became the BHASED principal, Kristen asked me what my main goal was. I didn't even hesitate and said it was to change the climate to a positive one that included all stakeholders, she said to board members and the crowd. Skinner gave several examples of how she and other BHASED leaders have worked to build this positive climate, such as increasing family engagement, regrouping the district's Crisis Prevention Institute team, which she said has resulted in fewer cases annually, where staff must use physical restraint holds to de-escalate students, Monday monthly team meetings aimed at boosting staff morale, and new community partnerships. She also cited a climate survey taken by the majority of BHASED center staff in partnership with the Rock Island Regional Office of Education, saying the regional office staff were impressed by the scores. The center is far from hostile, she said. The executive board calling the paper and picketing before even asking to resolve anything has hurt our school, staff, and parents. I know this because parents have reached out and have asked me if they can do anything. Skinner said one parent was even hesitant to inquire about general IEP-related matters with her for fear of causing adding stress amidst the situation. My parents could never bother me. I love this school, my parents, students, staff, and administration, she said. As I have walked into the lobby when greeting, hello, or saying goodbye, I've even had parents grabbing my arm or telling me to hang in there. To Skinner, this kind of response reflects the BHASED Center's theme this year, Ohana, a native Hawaiian term for family. We are Ohana here, she said in closing. In an email to the Quad City Times Wednesday afternoon, Schrader said the administration was committed to working to move the organization forward. We are committed to working collaboratively and proactively with the association leadership, our staff, our administrative team, our superintendents, and our board to move our organization forward and continue our work supporting the students, their families, and the communities we serve, she said. Following public comment, BHA SED union members, in support of Schrader and Skinner's resignation, addressed the governing board in a lengthy closed session meeting. While the reasoning is unclear, Buck is on a 10-day administrative leave, Buck said in a message to the Dispatch Argus. He was not present at the meeting. Stephanie Olvera, the union representative for BHA SED's Phoenix program in Carbon Cliff, spoke on behalf of Buck during this time, along with sharing her own concerns. During my 9 years' experience, we have continuously been severely understaffed. This has placed both students and staff under great stress. The safety of our students and staff should be the number one priority, she told the Dispatch Argus on Tuesday, reading from the remarks she planned to share in closed session. Olvera said her site is understaffed by 2 teachers and 5 paraprofessionals and also needs more social workers to handle extreme behavior from students. Due to staffing constraints, Olvera also claims staff haven't been able to take unpaid meal breaks for the last 2 to 3 years. The understaffing puts staff at risk, including potential for bodily injury when students have outbursts, she said. We are in peril every day from these students, she said. There are not enough social workers nor staff to contain students' incidents and behaviors. Students are not able to be redirected and kept not only in their classrooms but in their assigned area. Olvera also said the school contains broken classroom doors, which have yet to see needed repairs due to lack of administrative action, another safety concern. The staff at the Phoenix program are grateful to now have a part-time resource officer. In reality, we need a full-time officer on site, she said in closing. This was a step in the right direction. There are many steps to go. The staff and students deserve our time and attention. The Illinois Education Association did not immediately respond to reporters' inquiries.
Okay, now we'll turn to obituaries. John Jack Ketelaar, that is spelled K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, November 24th, 1942 to December 17, 2023. Jack Ketelaar, 81, passed away peacefully in hospital after declining health issues. Born in Davenport, Iowa, Jack moved to California in his early adulthood, San Francisco, and later in Contra Costa County. He developed his professional career, married, raised his family, and retired to spend his last few years in Napa with family. He is preceded in death by his parents, Alan Vera Ketelaar, siblings Robert, Bob, Shirley, Mary Lou, and brother-in-law, William Bill, and most importantly, the love of his life, his wife of 45 years, Mary Maureen Ketelaar, née Connelly. He is survived by his remaining siblings, William, Bill, and Michael, Mike, in-law siblings, Joe, Ann, Barbara, and Maureen, his children Siobhan, Brianna, and Bridget, his son-in-law Liam, and granddaughter Ada, as well as a number of nieces and nephews. His early professional years were spent in the banking industry and latterly became a business owner before enjoying full retirement. Stating no regrets, his life included a strong commitment to his family, living life his way, and an avid football fan, college and professional level, with die-hard commitments to the Denver Broncos, as well as a keen interest in business, history, and train travel. He taught us to remain true to what you believe in and support, live life to its fullest, and give it your all until the very end. We would like to give thanks to both Kaiser Hospital, Napa and Vallejo, and DaVita Dialysis in Napa for their ongoing support, care, and compassion. Although he will be missed, we find comfort in the knowledge that Jack is now at peace and truly put up a good fight. Upon his wishes, he will be cremated, and although a longtime member of Christ the King Catholic Church, Pleasant Hill, there will be no memorial service. Nancy L. Kaplan, February 7, 1932 to January 13, 2024. Nancy L. Kaplan, 91, of Anthem, Arizona, formerly of the Quad Cities, died Saturday, January 13th, due to an extended illness at Anthem Senior Living Facility. Services will be at 1 p.m. on Sunday, January 21st, at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Burial will follow at Hebrew Cemetery in Rock Island. Memorials may be made to the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities. Nancy, a graduate of Davenport High School, was born on February 7, 1932, in Rock Island, the eldest daughter of George and Lee Sachs Shaman. On December 14, 1952, Nancy married the love of her life, Morton Kaplan of Omaha, Nebraska, who she met when she was 14 years old at BBYO convention. Throughout their nearly 60 years together, they lived in every one of the Quad Cities, starting their life in Moline and ultimately raising their family in Bettendorf. Nancy was always a leader, starting as an advisor for nearly 20 years in the local chapter of B'nai B'rith Youth Organization with Mort, and then president of B'nai B'rith Women and Beth Israel Sisterhood. She also was treasurer for both organizations. Bookkeeping was a big part of her life, starting at a job in New York when she was 18. She moved back to Davenport in 1952 to marry Mort. She continued her bookkeeping for the family business, Davenport Produce. In 1992, Nancy and her daughter Sherry bought the fiber shop, a yarn shop they ran together until 2012. Nancy was an avid game player. She played Mahjong with the same group for more than 60 years. Nancy also enjoyed bridge, dominoes, and many other card games of which she was a master at all. She moved with her daughter and son-in-law to Anthem, Arizona in 2018, and while it was hard to leave a community in which she had lived her whole life, she got to see more of her family more often. Family was everything to Nancy and Mort. They raised four children, Todd Kaplan in Lenexa, Kansas, Mark, his wife Therese Kaplan in Los Angeles, Lisa, husband Rick Jackson in Anthem, Arizona, and Sherry, husband Greg Kinman in Anthem, Arizona. They also spent as much time as possible with their four grandchildren, Sydney and Jordan Kinman, Adam Jackson, and Adriana Kaplan. Mort preceded her in death in 2012. Nancy led a wonderful life and will be greatly missed. Say hi to Dad for us and play lots of Maj. Online condolences may be left at www.whelanpresley.com. James G. Zuidema, that is spelled Z-U-I-D-E-M-A, May 3, 1944, January 15, 2024. James G. Zuidema, 79, a resident of Bettendorf, California, Iowa, died Monday, January 15th, at the Davenport Lutheran Home. Visitation will be from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday, January 20th, at the McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Graveside services will be at a later date at the Rock Island National Cemetery, where military honors will be accorded. Memorials may be made to the disabled American veterans. James was born in Morrison, Illinois on May 3, 1944, the son of Glenn and Grace Norman Zuidema. Following high school graduation, he enlisted in the U.S. Navy and served with the Helicopter Sea Combat Squadron 9. He was honorably discharged in 1966 after 4 years of service. On August 24, 1991, he was united in marriage to Trudy Noreen Tollinger in Moline, Illinois. James was employed as an electrician with the Alcoa Company, retiring after 25 years of service. Following retirement, he operated Mr. Rotobar, an electronic teaching predictive maintenance service. His memberships included the American Legion and the Alcoa Retirees. He was an avid walker and enjoyed dancing for many years. Those left to honor his memory include his wife, Trudy, his daughter, Susan Zudema of Davenport, his son, Scott Zudema of Cambridge, Illinois, and Craig's wife, Melissa Zudema of Morrison, Illinois, his grandchildren, Jessica, Laura, and Anthony, his great-grandchildren, Isabel and Jays, and his sister, Patricia Stoker of Morrison, Illinois. James was preceded in death by his brothers, Ron and Jerry Zudema. Condolences may be expressed to the family by viewing his obituary at www.mcginnischambers.com. Barbara Joel Truman, September 6, 1952 to January 12, 2024. Barbara Joel Truman, 71, a resident of Bettendorf, Iowa, passed away unexpectedly on Friday, January 12th at her home. A celebration of her life is being planned for early spring. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Scott County Humane Society or any animal welfare organization of your choice. McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home of Bettendorf is assisting the family with arrangements. She was born in Iowa City on September 6, 1952, the daughter of Herbert and Geraldine Walsh Plateter. Barb was a 1970 graduate of Iowa City West High School and a 1975 graduate of the University of Iowa, where she earned her degree in speech pathology. On October 3, 1997, she was united in marriage to Barry Truman at First Christian Church in Davenport. Barb was blessed with four beautiful children, 10 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren, whom she loved and cherished very much. Barb was truly a gift from God to her husband and her beloved family. She worked as a speech and language pathologist and editor for Linguist Systems, retiring in 2010. Barb excelled academically during her years in high school and college. She loved music, played the piano and organ, and loved to travel. She had a soft spot in her heart for animals, especially her beloved canine companions, Penny, Tribble, Tucker, and Moonstar. And she was a forever Iowa Hawkeye fan. Those left to honor her memory included her husband, Barry, her children, Jason, wife, Jolene, Walter of Bettendorf, Jennifer, husband, Jared Arndt of DeWitt, Ethan, wife Katrina, Walter of Bradenton, Florida, and Adam Truman of Bettendorf, her grandchildren Desiree, husband Greg Vine, Brandon Darling, Chloe Griffin, Courtney and husband Kyle Walter, Liam Walter, Jacob Walter, Bodie Walter, Jack Arndt, Adeline Arndt, and Avery Arndt. Her great-grandchildren, Gerard Vine, Aurora, Van, and Beckett Vine. Her sisters-in-law, Pat Truman and Judy Carbaugh. Her brothers-in-law, Tim and Les Truman. Brad and wife, Leanne Truman. And Gary, wife, Lynn Truman. And numerous nieces and nephews. An aunt and uncle. Many cousins and close and special friends. Barbara is preceded in death by her brother, Denny Platt Tedder, her brother-in-law Greg Truman, her parents, and her grandparents. Condolences may be expressed to the family by viewing her obituary at www.mcginnischambers.com. Dora May Mercer, October 4, 1936 to January 15, 2024. Dora May Mercer, 87, a resident of Fairfield, formerly of Davenport, passed away Monday, January 15, 2024, at Parkview Care Center in Fairfield. Funeral services celebrating her life will be at 2 p.m. Saturday, January 20th, at Benner Funeral Home in Fairfield. Burial will be at Grand Cemetery in Rome, Iowa. Memorials may be made to your local animal shelter. Dora was born October 4, 1936, in Mount Pleasant, the daughter of George and Pearl Miller Doherty. She married Darrell Mercer March 23, 1957. He preceded her in death April 10, 1996. Dora worked for Sears Manufacturing in Davenport. She enjoyed traveling, camping, spending time outdoors. While indoors, she was enthralled any world games James Patterson was writing about, watching every episode of CSI and shopping on HSN. Above all things, she loved her dogs, Rain and Gypsy Rose. Those left to honor her memory include her son Laverne Mercer of Wapello, grandchildren Jessica, husband Matt Trammell, Clavino, and Amanda Clavino of Gordonsville, Tennessee, Jared, wife Maria Arceo Mercer, Kendra Mercer, and Paige Mercer of Davenport, great-grandchildren Joseph Clavino, John and Ray Lynn Trammell, and Adrian and Juliet Mercer, and her brother Donald Doherty. In addition to her husband, she was preceded in death by her parents, daughter Teresa Clavino, and sister Dolores Kraft. The family would like to express great gratitude to Parkview Care Center for their endless kindness in caring for Dora in the last 7 years of her life. Online condolences may be made to Dora's family by viewing her obituary at www.benearth.com.
You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we're going to turn to the opinion section. In the Another View column, this is from the Wall Street Journal. Do homeless have a right to vagrancy? Supreme Court will consider if cities such as San Francisco can enforce public order. Good news for West Coast denizens. The Supreme Court recently agreed to hear an appeal challenging a judicial ruling that established a de facto constitutional right to vagrancy. Wouldn't it be rich if conservative justices rescue progressive cities from themselves? City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. A panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2022 blocked the Oregon town of Grants Pass from enforcing anti-camping laws on public property. The judges said the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment prohibits cities from arresting or imposing penalties on homeless people for squatting on public property if there aren't enough shelter beds for every vagrant. Progressives have used the ruling to sue to stop cities across the West from enforcing similar laws. Under the appellate court's precedent, a police officer in, say, San Francisco can't cite a homeless person who has set up a tent inside a public playground, even if he has been offered temporary housing. Many homeless reject temporary shelter because they'd rather live on the streets where they can freely use drugs. The Ninth Circuit District has made it harder for local officials to use the threat of penalties to force vagrants to accept treatment for mental illness and drug addiction, which has contributed to the increasing disorder in West Coast cities. San Francisco Mayor London Breed last summer held a rally in front of the Ninth Circuit Courthouse to protest a lower court injunction blocking the city from clearing homeless camps. The judges weren't moved. A 2-to-1 majority of a 3-judge panel upheld the lower court ruling. In a fiery dissent, Judge Patrick Bumate explained that nothing in the text, history, and tradition of the Eighth Amendment comes close to prohibiting enforcement of commonplace anti-vagrancy laws. The court's sweeping injunction has no basis in the Constitution or our precedent, he added. San Francisco should not be treated as an experiment for judicial tinkering. Our decision is cruel because it leaves the citizens of San Francisco powerless to enforce their own health and safety laws without the permission of a federal judge, Judge Bumate wrote. And it's unusual because no other court in the country has interpreted the Constitution in this way. This may be one reason the High Court agreed to hear the Grants Pass appeal. Local governments in the Ninth Circuit's jurisdiction, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Phoenix, also urged justices to hear the case. That includes California Governor Gavin Newsom, who argued in a friend of court brief that courts are not well suited to micromanage such nuanced policy issues based on ill-defined rules. We look forward to Newsom's constitutional communion with Justice Clarence Thomas.
Okay, another by Jonah Goldberg, Biden late but right to strike against Yemen's Houthis. With the possible exception of fights over the national debt and Supreme Court nominations, no topic arouses more partisan hypocrisy than the presidential use of military force. And globally, there is no issue that arouses more hypocrisy than Israel. Put them together and you have a perfect storm of double standards. Let's establish some relevant facts. On October 7, Iran-backed Hamas launched a brutal attack on Israel, a close American ally, from Gaza. Israel counterattacked. President Biden repeatedly warned regimes in the region, specifically Iran, not to get involved. On October 24, Secretary of State Antony Blinken vowed America would respond to attacks on American forces, swiftly and decisively. Iran didn't listen, and America didn't respond swiftly or decisively. Iranian-backed militias attacked American bases in Iraq and Syria. In November, Houthis, an Iranian proxy group which controls parts of Yemen, started a launching rocket, drone, and missile attack on both Israel and the international shipping in the Red Sea, with logistical support from Iran. Houthis claimed they were merely attacking ships trading with Israel, but the attacks were indiscriminate, ensnaring ships with no ties to Israel and dislocating global trade. In December, a U.S. warship shot down three drones in self-defense. Last week, after intense criticism for failing to make good on his warnings, Biden ordered significant attacks on Houthi assets in Yemen, with assistance from Britain and other allies. There isn't room to feast on the banquet of hypocrisies on offer, but let's nibble on the most obvious. One of the first things Biden did on taking office was to remove the Houthis from the official list of terrorist organizations. He now says they are terrorists. Many on the right blistered Biden for dithering, are now angry he didn't consult with Congress before retaliating. Many on the left, who had no objections to the Obama-Biden administration's attacks on Libya in 2011, are mad at Biden for attacking a group allied with Hamas. Anti-Semitism, we're constantly told, has nothing to do with anti-Zionism. The official slogan of the Houthis is, God is great, death to the U.S., death to Israel, curse the Jews, and victory for Islam. You can tell me that death to Israel is merely anti-Zionist, but curse the Jews? Perhaps because such hypocrisy is so hard to defend, the substance of opposition to the strikes is either to American military escalation or to escalation without required congressional approval. Throughout this crisis, escalation has been code for striking back. Even in the immediate hours after Hamas butchery, there were demands that Israel not escalate by responding. As for America, many opponents of escalation had no problem with Houthi and Iranian escalation by indiscriminately attacking global shipping and threatening American interests. This illustrates the weakness of the constitutional argument. In March 1801, President Jefferson dispatched two-thirds of the U.S. Navy to wage war on the Barbary pirates. He didn't formally notify Congress until December. That constitutionally dubious War Powers Act requires congressional authorization for the use of force, except in cases of, quote, a national emergency created by an attack upon the United States, its territories, or possessions, or its armed forces, end quote. Even if, for some tendentious reason, you do not believe the Houthi attacks qualify for the one facet of a broader Iranian aggression and escalation, I have no objection to getting congressional buy-in, and Biden's critics have a point. If he was willing to wait this long to respond to the Houthi attacks, he could have consulted with Congress. But that's the real problem. He shouldn't have waited that long in the first place.
And we have one more opinion column here by Patricia Lopez, scrap the Iowa caucuses, which are out of step and stale. The Iowa caucus has become an outdated relic. Like 8-track cassettes and checkbooks, it served a valuable purpose at one time, but no longer. Donald Trump, as he has with so many things, reset the rules of the political game in Iowa, essentially turning the state into a backdrop for his brand of theatrics. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, on the other hand, played by the old rules. He dutifully visited each of Iowa's 99 counties, poured money into building the ground game that everyone said was needed, knocked a million doors, and held 136 events in the last year, fielding voter requests at every turn. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley followed a similar, if less intense, path, bouncing between Iowa and New Hampshire. Trump? He held a couple of dozen rallies, including some tele-rallies, sent in a handful of surrogates, and staged photo ops like the one on Sunday, where he delivered convenience store pizza to firefighters in Waukee. He did invest in a well-run ground operation, but also rejected every debate against his challengers and took few impromptu questions from voters. For this, Trump was rewarded with a historic win on Monday night, romping to a landslide that demonstrated his demographic strength in every corner of the state and among every kind of voter. DeSantis battled his way to a distant second, a full 30 points behind Trump, with Haley close behind in third. In a final bid of ignominy, networks called the race for Trump before Iowans had even finished casting their secret votes. It wasn't supposed to be this way. The concept behind the Iowa caucus was both noble and novel when it debuted in 1972. Ordinary Iowans, farmers, factory workers, small business owners, waitresses, sales clerks, would be able to vet presidential candidates in small forums designed to push past rote talking points and stump speeches to get to something real and meaningful. No handlers, no rope lines, just candidates and prospective voters. That was before trackers and long before the internet and social media. Iowans took their responsibilities seriously, priding themselves on their ability to take a true measure of a candidate and the organizations behind them. I like the history of it, said Mike Klosterman, owner of a spice shop near the Capitol in Des Moines, but those days are gone. Its time has passed. Klosterman still marvels that he personally met 3 candidates who went on to become president, but the caucus is increasingly out of step with how modern America lives, works, and picks its presidential candidates. Out of step, too, with how modern campaigns roll. Larry Jacobs, director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota, said the Iowa caucus is a political system that has far outlived even its most modest claims. The caucus, he said, has become a giant moneymaker for Iowa that also favors voters who are connected to special interest and ideological groups and extremists. Because it's held over a couple of hours on a weekday evening during the bitterest part of winter, many Iowans are excluded from the process. Unlike primary voting, there are no absentee ballots, no early voting periods, because it's a parity process. There is no time off from work to vote. Minnesota was also a caucus state at one point, Jacob said, but the rebellion against the lack of inclusivity became too much. When Minnesotans lined up for blocks to caucus for Barack Obama in 2008, he said they threw up their hands at a process for democracy that just wasn't working. Minnesota went to a presidential primary after 2016. Can the caucus ever go back to its glory days? Unlikely. Social media has made candidates far too careful, and the big money needed to run modern campaigns demands that little be left to chance. The people who show up are so unlike the rest of America, the rest of the state, Jacob said. It's just not reflective. Not since 2000 has the winner of a contested Republican Iowa caucus gone on to win the presidency. Now, Trump has shown that there is no need to play by the rules in Iowa, exposing the falseness of the narrative about small-town democracy, even as he benefits from it. The Iowa caucus, even if it survives, may never be the same. And that again was from Patricia Lopez, who is a Bloomberg columnist and former member of the editorial board at the Minneapolis Star Tribune, where she also worked as a senior political editor and reporter. Okay, I think we have time for some sports where you can catch it on the air. With college men's basketball, tonight at 5:30, Minnesota is at Michigan State on FS1. At 6 o'clock, We have Monmouth at Drexel on CBS SN. Also at 6 o'clock on ESPN, South Florida is at Memphis. 6 o'clock on ESPN2, we have Wichita State, FAU. And on ESPNU at 6 o'clock, we have UNC Asheville at Winthrop. At 7:30 on FS1, Illinois is at Michigan. At 8 o'clock on CBS SN, Middle Tennessee is at UTEP. At 8 o'clock on ESPN2, Oregon State is at Utah. And on the Pac-12 network at 8 o'clock, Washington is at California. At 9:30 on FS1, Oregon is at California. At 10 o'clock on CBS SN, Loyola Marymount is at San Francisco. Also at 10 o'clock, Washington State is at Stanford, and you can catch that on the Pac-12 network. In college women's basketball, at 5 o'clock on ACCN, North Carolina is at Georgia Tech. At 6 o'clock, Purdue is at Penn State. You can see that on BTN. Also at 6 o'clock on SECN, Tennessee is at Mississippi State. At 7 o'clock on ACCN, Virginia Tech is at Duke. At 8 o'clock on SECN, LSU is at Alabama. You can catch golf noon today on the Golf Channel LPGA Tour Tournament of Champions. On ESPN2 at 1 o'clock, Latin America Amateur Championship. Also on the Golf Network at 3 o'clock, PGA Tour American Express. 6 o'clock, the Champions Tour Mitsubishi Championship. And in the NBA at 6:30 tonight on TNT, Chicago is at Toronto. And also on TNT at 9 o'clock, Memphis is at Minnesota. Chicago at Buffalo at 6 o'clock on NBC SCH. And soccer at 1 o'clock, the Italian Cup semifinal, Napoli versus Fiorentina on CBS SN. Finally, at 8 o'clock tonight, the Australian Open on ESPN and ESPN2. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.